Welcome to the second episode of the Living Room Times podcast with Brendan and Becky. That was Loyette singing the Liberty Tree song, which we ended last week's podcast with, so we thought we would start this week's podcast with it. We planted a Liberty Tree this week.
Yes, we did. That was a wonderful, wonderful day for me because our foster dog went to the vet to get spayed. So I took her to the vet, which taking a dog to the vet with two kids is awesome. So I took the dog to the vet, then went to the store, and it was just about rush hour to pick up a 12-foot tree to plant in our front yard, where we had a 3-foot hole from where our other tree was removed, so we really needed to get another tree and plant it. So I figured, you know, I'll buy a tree, and then I'll go home, and Brendan can either watch the girls or plant the tree, and we'll just trade off this responsibility. And then he called me as I was driving home with the tree and said, I'm stuck at work, so I might not be home till 7. Now, I had book club at 7:15, so, I ended up feeding the girls dinner and taking them out in the front yard and planting the tree by myself. Well, the girls frolicked and played, but really cottoned on to the idea that this was our very own Liberty Tree. So now we have a autumn blaze maple tree that is our Liberty Tree.
And Loyette is constantly asking she's constantly pointing at other trees and saying, look, Daddy, it's a Liberty Tree. Look, they have a Liberty Tree too. So every tree is a Liberty Tree. It's very exciting.
Yeah, so apparently there's a lot of liberty in the United States. Yeah. So I recommend planting a Liberty Tree with your children for Arbor Day. Yay. And that is our public service announcement of the day.
Yes. Thank you to everyone who tuned in to last week's podcast. We had 123 downloads, of which I think probably about 23 were me testing it. But we had at least 100 legitimate hits, I think. And we have apparently 13 subscribers, again, one of which is me. So 12 subscribers. So that's exciting.
Oh, I have to subscribe.
Soon we'll have 14 subscribers. Thank you for listening. And just to sort of test whether we actually have an audience that's going to answer questions and give us feedback, before we do our What Was Your Favorite Part segment, I wanted to pose a question to any parents who may be listening. Because I was thinking about this yesterday. I have this sort of strange, panicky sense that I get sometimes when I'm out with the girls, where I'll get them both in the car and I'll be driving down the road, leaving wherever we just were. Like yesterday, we went to this Scarecrow Festival. We're leaving the Scarecrow Festival, and I put both girls in the car, and I know that they're both in the car, and I can look in my rearview mirror and see that they're both in the car. But nevertheless, I'll have this like split second thought of like, oh my God, did I leave one of the girls behind? And I have to check. I'm look in the mirror to be sure they're both there, even though I know that they're both there. There's no reason that they wouldn't both be there. I obviously put them both there. And it's just this ingrained parental panic that I always have to, I don't know, I find that very strange. But I was just wondering if any other parents out there can relate to this, that you have this sense of occasional doom.
This never happens to me, so
yeah.
I always know that they're both back there.
So do I. That's the thing. I know that they are. My conscious mind knows that they are, but there's some little part of my subconscious that's freaking out that somehow.
So can we do the what's your favorite part? I'm gonna leave my
children behind. Okay. All right. So it's time for our I'll just play the clip and then we'll go.
What was your favorite part?
All right. I think you should go first.
Didn't I go first last time?
I don't care.
All right.
You can go first again. It's okay.
My favorite part of the week, it was a really weird week. I was working late a bunch, which is unusual, and Becky went out 5 of the last 6 nights or something.
Yeah,
either going out with friends or have an event or a parent teacher conference or something. And so I've barely seen any of you. I haven't seen as much of the girls as I usually do, and it just hasn't been the most fun week. But having said that, I think that my favorite part of the week, it might not be a specific event, but it's something that's been sort of happening over the last several weeks, and I've seen a bunch of examples of this week, which is just the two girls, how they're just the way that they're relating to each other more and more. And Loyacita is getting increasingly verbal and increasingly good at expressing herself. And Loyette is just so charmed and fascinated by this and is constantly wanting to talk to her and teach her things. She loves the concept that she can teach her things. It's actually, I think it's going to be a really great little behavior modification tool to be like, you know, you have to teach your sister this, that, or the other thing. She seems to really...
how to behave, how to be a big girl, how to talk like a big girl, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. She seems to really like that. But I've just been noticing it a lot with them. And Becky actually caught a really good clip of it that I was going to play that I've edited slightly to try to take out the names. But it's just a video clip, which I'll play as an audio clip, of Loyette reading part of a Dora book to Loyacita and pointing things out to her. Anyway, without further ado, here it is.
Here's the gum you're dropping. Here is the gum. Here's 12%. Here's the gum you're dropping. The gum you're dropping is a whale for us. Yes, Dora. Dora. No, that's Boots. Miss Dora. No, that's the gum you're dropping. This is Dora.
I just think that's so cute. I just watching them, the way that they relate to each other more and more as Loyacita gets older is just so adorable and
makes gives me, us a lot to look forward to as parents.
It makes me really happy that we had them as close together as we did, even though that's been a real challenge at times. I was actually just musing today about how it blows my mind that pretty soon Loyacita will be as old as Loyette was when Loyacita was born. You know, that's coming up in a few months, right around Loyette's third birthday. And that just boggles my mind that could possibly already be true. So anyway, that's my sort of somewhat murky and non-specific favorite part of the week.
Well, I have a specific favorite part of the week, and that was actually our parent-teacher conference, because I personally think it's pretty hilarious that a two-year-old has a parent-teacher conference, but they do, and so they give you 15 minutes to talk about how your child is doing in school, and the parents that were two parents before me in the time slots talked for 45 minutes in their parent-teacher conference, and I was kind of like, you do realize that your child is two, don't you? I mean, it boggles my mind that there was that much to say. But then again, you know, when I went in for our parent-teacher conference, we got all positive feedback. So that was really, it was really wonderful. Something I'd sort of anticipated because our oldest is very, just very sociable and very kind is her nature. And so I would be shocked, for example, to get feedback that she would hit somebody or something like that, because that's just not who she is. But they said that she's a pleasure to have in class and that she's very very good with the other kids and empathetic, and she listens at story time. And, you know, my little mommy heartbeat was like, ah! I mean, I just felt very, I don't know, I guess, justified in my decision to stay home with them when I get positive feedback about them, which is bad because it puts the onus on them and not on me to just enjoy the parenting experience. But anyways, it was nice to get positive feedback. So that was my favorite part of the week.
So we had two topics again that we've sort of discussed talking about a little bit, and I think I'll go first with mine, and then the topic that I kind of proposed is one that came out of a Twitter argument that I was having a couple nights ago with a few people online. I suppose where else would you have a Twitter argument but online? About this issue that arose in California where an associate of Jerry Brown, who, and I have actually just gathered from a headline that I saw that now there's some indication maybe the associate with that was actually his wife, which is kind of funny. But anyway, an associate of Jerry Brown is the Democratic candidate for governor of California. Was caught on tape in a conversation with Brown, talking about their Republican opponent, Meg Whitman, and referring to her as a whore. And the dialogue between them was this. Brown was talking about, well, everybody said, quote, "Do we want to put an ad out that I have been warned if I crack down on pensions, I will be that they'll go to Whitman, and that's where they'll go because they know Whitman will give them, will cut them a deal, but I won't." Them presumably being, I guess, the public employees, the state employees, I assume. Yeah,
basically, that Whitman will abandon her principles and actually cave to the public employees right. just to get votes.
Right. And so then a second voice jumps in and says, "Well, what about saying she's a whore?" And then Brown says, "Well, I'm going to use that. It proves you've cut a secret deal to protect the pensions." I think it's pretty clear, unless you're being ridiculous, that when Brown said, "Well, I'm going to use that," I don't think he meant I'm going to use saying that she's a whore, because obviously no one's going to run an ad saying that. I think he was referring to his own dialogue that he had, and he's going to use this supposed cutting a deal thing, this concept. But leaving that aside, there's this whole controversy that's then immediately developed about the fact that some associate of Brown used the word whore to describe Whitman without him repudiating, or as Sarah Palin would say, refudiating that use of that word. And the Whitman campaign came out with a statement. In fact, here it is: "The use of the term whore is an insult to both Meg Whitman and to the women of Meg Whitman and the women of California. This is an appalling and unforgivable smear against Meg Whitman." And lots of conservative, you know, Matt Drudge, who seems to run the show in some ways in terms of right wing talking points, had a thing on top of his site that was, he called her what? And then it had all these links to it and stuff. And everyone was all mad. And then that the next day, the National Association for Women endorsed Brown. And so people on the right were like, "Oh my God, look at that. And that just, this just proves what Democratic shills and hypocrites now is, that they would endorse someone who just called a woman a whore." And my reaction to this is that, like, oh my God, give me a break. It's obvious from context. Obvious, like indisputable. That the word whore was not being used in a context having anything to do with gender or sex. What was being said was, she's a whore in the same sense that anyone, man or woman, and the term is used in this context for both, is a whore for selling out. That, you know, Mitt Romney is a whore for selling out his principles. Nancy Pelosi is a whore because she, you know, doesn't stand up for progressive values against her special interests, whatever your political affiliation is. The term whore is used in so many contexts these days, it's lost a lot of its taboo. And then maybe that's bad, but it's a fact. Media whore, attention whore, these terms are thrown around without any regard for the fact that originally the term whore was this awful slur that was only applied to women. It's not that way anymore. It's not applied only to women in those contexts. And it's not like anyone could possibly claim that what's being said in this clip is
Meg Whitman stands on street corners sells her cooch for a quarter.
Exactly. That's not what they're saying. Nor are they saying, nor is it just sort of a generic insult of her as a woman. Like, oh, she's a dumb whore because she's a woman. They're not saying that either. They're saying it's very specific. She's a whore because she'll go cut a deal with the public employee unions. That could and would be said about a man just as easily, and it is in modern political discourse. Now, was it an uncouth, insulting thing to say? Sure. It was obviously they didn't realize they were on tape. And I'm sure that people in the other camp say all sorts of uncouth things too. I mean, people make fun of Jerry Brown as being a nutbag all the time. But the reality is, what really irritates me about this, and I'll stop filibustering in a second and let you get a word in edgeways. I just want to get my little rant out.
You ranting? I refuse to hear it.
Yeah. The thing that irritates me about this so much is that to hear conservatives going on about this is a betrayal of what I used to believe was a fairly core conservative principle that I agreed with, which was that this sort of overzealous political correctness is ridiculous and should be fought against at every turn. And whenever I bring this up and point it out to conservatives, and this is where the argument on Twitter went, the response that I get is, well, look, if this were a Republican saying this about a Democratic woman, it would be an outrage, and the media would be pissed, and the Democrats would be pissed, and the National Organization for Women would be pissed. And you know what? Maybe that's true. But if that's true, the proper response is to scream bloody murder when that happens, not when the response to hypocrisy on the left is not to imitate the left. It's to call out the hypocrisy when you see it. And the response is that, oh, well, this means that we're just unilaterally disarming, and so this weapon is used against us, and we don't get to use this against anyone else, ignores the fact that what's actually happening now, and this isn't just an isolated incident. Sarah Palin has used this victimology, the woman's victimology, to great effect. So is Christine O'Donnell, though she's going to lose anyway. But the reality is that this has become a trope of the right now. It has become just as much a trope of the right as it's a trope of the left. And this sort of ironic sense of, let's say this to make a point, immediately in the media, in this media age that we're in, loses all nuance, and it becomes just the right adopting the same tactics. And now everyone is the PC police. We are all the PC police now. And I hate that, because I hate it when it's done to Republicans, and I hate it when it's done to Democrats. It's one thing if someone says something legitimately offensive, but when it's something like this, where it is clearly not what is being portrayed as, to go out and make an issue out of that is such a betrayal of something that I think is important, that conservatives used to stand for.
That's enough ranting.
All right,
Brennan.
Go.
What I have discussed with Brennan on this topic is that it's sauce for the goose and sauce for the gander, that both sides do it, and pretending that Republicans are...
Both sides are hypocritical.
About various things. In this way, that they will use this political correctness argument to their own gain. And I think I have an example of the Democrats doing it, and not doing it. And that example is with Bill Clinton, and then again with Bristol Palin. Because, the fact that Bill Clinton was getting his sucked by a woman who's not his wife while he was in office had the Republicans completely scandalized. And the liberals were like, really, it's a blowjob. Let's get over it and move on and get into the business of governing the country. And when Sarah Palin ran for office and it became apparent that her unmarried teenage daughter was pregnant, there was some outcry on the left, like, oh, but she has an unmarried child with a baby in her uterus. And frankly, I find that you can't be ideologically consistent, really. I mean, nobody loves teen pregnancy, but, like, the fact that the kid was having sex is not that big of a scandal or a deal. If you don't think it's a big deal that Bill Clinton's tapping the intern. You can't be like, oh, it's okay to tap the intern, but it's not okay for like, the 17-year-old to be having sex. Leaving the pregnancy aside. I think I think that both sides do it, and the sort of sense of umbrage is completely dependent on political gain and capacity. Like, I honestly don't think that Matt Drudge would be terribly offended if somebody was like, Nancy Pelosi is a whore. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. You wouldn't get the same outrage. And if the outrage was against calling a woman a whore, then it should be consistent regardless of ideology. But it's not. It's all about playing a political game, and the sooner that we understand that, the better. Now, if you want to use these incidences as examples of why we need to introduce more civility into politics, that, like, perhaps you really shouldn't be thinking of your opponent as a complete and utter unprincipled whore who would stoop so low as to make deals with unions as a Republican just to get votes, if you want to say that, like, we should be looking at ourselves and trying to be more kind to one another, as I got onto in our last podcast discussion, that's fine with me. But no, I think it's just political maneuvering. And frankly, if once you look at it like that, it's kind of amusing to see who's going to abandon their principles next when it suits their needs. Like, how scandalous it is that Sarah Palin, a mother with children, should be, running for office. You get these very feminist women who are suddenly scandalized by the concept, as if that's not what feminism should have been fighting for all along, as for to give the Sarah Palins of the world opportunity. And frankly, there are so many better reasons not to like Sarah Palin than the fact that she's a mom with kids. But, these things expose a nasty hypocrisy in both the left and the right. And that's that, we like to pretend that our own crap doesn't stink. And it stinks for both sides.
I think I have a couple comments on that. First of all, I completely agree with you about the substance of your comparison to the left and sexual issues. And I'll get to why I completely agree in a second. But I just want to say, that just for the sake of argument, I do think it is possible to make a distinction between the Clinton situation and the Bristol Palin situation in that one of them involves consenting adults, one of them involves arguably a and I'm not saying this is my position, but arguably you say, well, you know, she wasn't doing a good job supervising her child who was underage, blah, blah, blah. Those are different issues. Having said that, the overall, I think there's probably a better example out there than Bill Clinton to compare to Bristol Palin. I don't know what it is. But the overall point that you're making is absolutely valid. And the point is that the left has, in the very much the same way that the right does with the political correctness, the left has shown repeatedly a willingness to abandon its principles with regard to the issue of the bedroom doesn't matter. What you do in the bedroom doesn't matter. It's your own business. And the reason their rationale for doing it is precisely the same as the right's rationale for this, for abandoning their principles and political correctness. And the rationale is, well, look, if it were a Democrat who were sleeping around or whose daughter was pregnant or whatever, the right would be all up in arms. The Christian conservatives would be mad about it. So now we're going to imitate them and act the way they would act. It's the same thing you see whenever you have like a preacher who turns out to be gay, and people are like, oh my goodness. And the thing is, it's one thing to say, look, okay, dude, you're a hypocrite. And that's fine. If that's all you're saying, but it always goes beyond that to the point of like, ah, he's gay, you know, and there's this underlying.
Or like that all Christians are somehow hypocrites because they're right. involved in, and then they're not personally involved in it. It paints groups with too broad a brush.
But the thing, the distinction that I want to make a little bit with what you were saying is that although I'm perfectly capable of being very cynical, I think that I would draw a distinction between something issues like this and issues where I expect both sides to be total hypocrites. For example, I have long ago accepted the fact that when it comes to elections and the way that election results are counted and the way that election-related groups operate and all the sort of procedural issues surrounding elections, everyone is a complete hypocrite. You know,
everybody just wants to win.
Everybody, right. Yeah. Everyone loves recounts when they help them and hates them when they hurt them. And that's just, I accept that. That's just a matter of people getting caught up in trying to win. But on these two issues, I think that it's worth complaining about the hypocrisy. Because when it comes to the right and political correctness, that wasn't just supposed to be something that they pretended to care about for political gain. That was something that was an important tenet, I thought, of being a conservative. Was, you know what, we need to stand up. I mean, not the most important, certainly. Not even the top 10, but it was important.
Well, that conservatives can tell racist jokes and still laugh
no,
about
well,
them?
No, not that they can tell racist jokes, but that we need to stand up against this overzealous PC police who want to just, you know, turn everything into a big...
To sterilize everything.
Sterilize everything, exactly. And it was one of the things back in like the early part of this decade, or the last decade, where I found myself a little bit more drawn to the right, you know, when I was sort of going through my I'm not sure if I'm a Democrat
Your
anymore phase.
Political awakening.
Yeah, yeah, where I'm like, you know what, I agree with the left on some things, but I really agree with the right on this, that the left should not be such morons about political correctness. Similarly, it's the idea that the government and politics and the media and everybody should just kind of leave the bedroom alone and it's mind your own business is supposed to be a core principle of being a liberal in America. That's just not right. That we shouldn't care about that stuff.
Save for things that are absolutely unacceptable.
Oh, of course, of course.
You know, that the bedroom, you know,
right.
It doesn't matter.
But if it's consenting adults and it's you know, not just totally repugnant.
Yeah, who's putting what where does not matter.
Exactly.
As long as it's
exactly.
consenting adults.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so to abandon principles that are that, like, important, that are core principles like that, for the sake of political victory, I think you win the battle and you lose the war. Because you abandon something that you care about, and now there's no one fighting for that principle anymore. And no one will take you seriously when you
yeah,
want to start fighting for it again.
Is it more important to be politically correct, or is it more important to have the governorship of California?
Well, see, that's always the argument that any like good Machiavellian will use. But I think, like I said, you win the battle and you lose the war. You win the governorship of California and you lose the cultural and political... the meta argument over
and
that issue.
And the Brendan Loys of the world. There's not that many voters like you out there. There are a lot of voters who will be like, I can't believe this man called a woman a whore. I'm voting against him.
Well, no, but right. But exactly. And then guess what? Now that means the political, the PC police have scored another victory.
That's why people do it, is because it works.
Right. But
shouldn't the voters be the ones holding the candidates accountable for this kind of behavior, to be like, you are cynically using...
No, because the voters are so easily manipulated.
Because,
I have no faith
because,
in the voters.
Yeah,
this has been well established.
Because the voters are the unwashed masses.
Yeah.
So
I'm an elitist on that, and that's been well established, and that's why I'll never have a political career. But I think that people who are opinion leaders, commentators, as well as politicians, though I hold them in less regard, need to be held to a higher standard, in the sense that if you are promoting a hypocritical belief, you have advanced the cause that you said that you wanted to fight against. And now we're in a situation where, there is no one sticking up for the principle anymore. So that means that principle loses.
I could see how, like, you hold your ruling class to a higher standard of behavior. I accept that. and you want them to fight for some kind of principle and perhaps see it as an extension of how they will be as politicians. That if someone is willing to abdicate a principle for victory, perhaps they'll do the same thing while they're in office.
Well, that's true, but I guess my point is even maybe a little bit more, it doesn't require that next logical leap. I'm not even assessing Jerry Brown or Whitman, yes, or anyone else as a potential governor or whatever. What I'm saying is there's a larger issue here. There's a meta sort of cultural argument that goes on all the time through media cycles in these sorts of... I'm almost done. In these sorts of debates, and when we're at a point where somebody like Sarah Palin can achieve so much success by playing the victim the way that liberals always used to do, and still do, but now conservatives do too, and once that drug, it's like a drug. Once you realize how effective it is, it's really hard not to start doing it. And pretty soon, everybody's doing it, and there is no one standing up for the alternative way of doing things. And similarly, there's no one anymore really standing up for the principle across the board that the bedroom doesn't matter as long as it's consenting adults, because guess what? It's when it's Republicans who do it, all of a sudden it's a scandal. And I think that we lose sight. Commentators and politicians and everybody tends to lose sight of those broader meta-cultural arguments because they're in the trenches, and individual. And I think they shouldn't. I think it's important to point out they shouldn't.
Okay.
All right, your topic now.
Thank God. My goodness. He could have gone on all day about that.
I could go on all day about anything. How long have you been married to me?
So my topic actually is a topic Brendan came up with, and he wanted to talk a little bit about Dave Ramsey. Now, if you don't know who Dave Ramsey is, he's the debt-free guy who tells people that their number one financial goal should be getting out of debt. And that getting out of debt feels awesome, and it frees you up to be able to use your money the way that you want. I am a Dave Ramsey fan. Brendan is not so much of a Dave Ramsey fan. And one of the issues that we fight about is our student loans.
My student loans, yes, precisely.
Precisely. I don't have any student loans. We don't have any car loans, and we don't have any credit card debt. Yay, us. And we're very... committed to staying out of that kind of debt. But we have this student loan debt, and my argument is that, we should Dave Ramsey it, and we should try to take our extra money, as tiny an amount as that may be, because we have a fairly tight budget right now, and we should take extra money that we make and toss it towards the debt. Now, Brendan feels like this is pissing into a hurricane wind right now, because... the amount of money that we can put towards the debt relative to the size of the debt is not a lot. It's pennies to $100 bills. But I still think it's probably worth it to try to pay down the debt. But we are actually in a unique financial situation as opposed to most of Dave Ramsey's listeners. And that most of the people that Dave Ramsey is preaching to are people who are the relative average American who make about 50 grand a year. And we'll always make about 50 grand a year. And so they really do need to sit down and say, okay, I need to get out of this debt now, however I can, because I'm always going to be making 50 grand a year, and this debt will always be there unless I challenge it. But that's not our situation. Our situation is a little bit different in that Brendan is at the very beginning of his earning potential, and so he's earning less now than he will in, say, 5 years.
That's me knocking on wood. But yeah. I mean, the premise of that obviously is I'm in my second year as an attorney. I'm an associate at a firm, and presumably, as time goes on, my salary will increase, because that's generally how things work in my field. There's a lot of potential for advancement, and a lot of it is based on seniority, income advancement, and it's largely based on seniority. At least up to a point. After a point, it starts to become based on just money you're bringing in and the profitability of your firm and whatnot when you're a partner. But it's a different situation than being at sort of a job that's either kind of a dead end job or a job that
has a stable salary,
and you might go up a little bit, but it's not going to, you wouldn't expect it to leap forward and that 5 or 10 years down the road, you're going to, again, knock on wood, be in a substantially more comfortable situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the situation we're looking at. And so our argument that we have is that I think that we should still pay down the debt anyway. Brendan thinks that we should make the payments that we make now, which are basically the minimum payments, and that we should take any extra money that we get and use it on other things. But, you know, our kids are not going to be young forever, and we'd like to take them on a vacation now or then, which we don't have fluff in the budget to do right now. And, you know, we have other expenses around the house. It's just, you know, being able to go out to eat, for example, or, like, we could buy a grill or patio furniture or, you know, plant some pretty flowers. You know, these are sort of lifestyle choices that we're debating about, and also sort of value judgments as to where how we want to spend our money and where we'd like to put it. And the other thing is that Brendan does make a relatively valid point in that, you know, we could live a very ascetic lifestyle for the next 5 or 6 years and probably pay down at least half, if not more, of the student loans doing that. Or we could wait until he possibly makes partner and pay them off in a year without making too much of a sacrifice to do it.
And my whole, you know, the point and the point in this discussion isn't necessarily to bicker on our podcast so much as just to sort of air out this interest, what I think is an interesting question of you know, how Dave Ramsey's gospel, if you will, speaks to people in different situations. Because my whole thought is that, you know, if we scrimp and save to make, you know, a dent in our debt, it might mean that we end up paying off the whole thing like 3 months sooner or something, or 2 months sooner. You know, to me, given the fact that we aren't really going to be probably improving things by leaps and bounds down the road in terms of how quick, if it was like we can pay it off 5 years earlier, because otherwise we'd be making the minimum payments forever. Because that's the whole Dave Ramsey principle, or part of it is that, you know, you make more than the minimum payment now and you end up cutting a huge amount off the 30-year or 15-year or 20-year, whatever it is, time on the debt because of these little extra payments you're making now. But the problem is that we don't have any intention of having it be a 15, 20, 30-year process. At least with the student loan debts. I don't know about the mortgage, but you know, certainly on the student loan debts, you know, once we have the ability to throw a ton of extra money at them, we intend to do that. And I'm on board with that. Once we have that extra money, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense to say, let's throw little bits and bits of money now to do something that at the end of the day will allow us to pay off those debts, you know, not 5 years sooner, but maybe 5 months sooner.
Or 6 months sooner, yeah.
If that.
And I think that Brendan has a compelling argument that we may fall outside of Dave Ramsey's core audience in that regard.
But you still want to be able to call up his radio show and go 1, 2, 3, we're debt free, woo!
Yeah, because I mean, imagine how awesome that would be.
I'll play a clip of that at the end of this podcast so we can
say
what we're talking about. That's on his show. People who have paid off either all of their debts or everything except their mortgage will call up and they'll talk about how much they were in debt and how they paid it off and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end they go, 1, 2, 3, we're debt free. And it's this big cathartic thing.
Yeah.
It's like Becky's dream in life.
It is my dream in life. I would love to not have these giant student loans hanging over us because I imagine what else we could do with the money that is currently going towards the loan. And while I understand that the loans, you know, have given you your education, at the same time, I hate them and I want to get out of them. But I mean, frankly, you know, like I make what, like maybe $200 a month, you know, and like throwing $200 a month at those loans is just it's just silly, you know, it really is. At a certain point, like they are so enormous that I would rather, like you said, I'd rather take that $200 a month and say, okay, let's take a weekend trip to Wyoming with the girls, or, you know, let's just wait a little while until we're in a better place to be able to actually make a substantial impact on that kind of debt.
See, I got that on tape, so now I can use that against you. We should have all of our arguments on the podcast, and then I would just win them all, apparently.
What? I don't agree with that at all.
I don't think I have anything else to say because you just conceded my argument, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have anything else to say about this topic, or do you want to do the 3-minute spousal who cares challenge?
Oh, yes. I am ready for the spousal who cares 3-minute challenge.
Would you like to operate the...
No. You can do the clock watch.
All right. You two tell me when to start.
Start.
All right.
Okay, so one of the things that I did this week was go to a lecture by Deborah Madison, who is the vegetarian author who won the James Beard Award for her Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone cookbook. And she was talking about farmers markets and the history of farmers markets. And one of the things that she mentioned was that a lot of current farmers markets got their start in the 1960s and 70s. And she was also talking about visiting farmers market as a way to experience seasonal and regional food. I wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Farmers markets as a way to, I toned out halfway through that. Okay, to taste seasonal and regional food. I like farmers markets. I mean, we go to our farmers market. I feel like I take the girls to the farmers market like every other week or every third week or something.
We have a little farmer's market in our neighborhood that we can walk to. So the girls really like to go and get like a waffle and run around the green.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess I don't really think of it in terms of the food. I mean, I know that's kind of the point of a farmer's market, but I think of it more as like, let's go there and run around in the grass. I do think that like your sort of, this is sort of half on topic, but you did this with my topic last week, so I'm going to do it to you too. I do think that your sort of general trend towards foodiness, mild foodiness, I suppose. You're not a hardcore foodie.
Oh, I'll get there.
Yeah. Has had a positive effect on my quality of life in the sense that, like, you know, when we were living in South Bend, we were, like, going to Dairy Queen all the time, and, like, I was kind of fat. and we went to Knoxville, and you decided, you know, you were pregnant, and you were like, okay, I'm going to start, like, living better, and you started cooking and getting, you know, as time went on, it started sort of small, but as time went on, you started like, get, you know, you'd buy some organic food when we can afford it and you'd, you know, get more fresh stuff and whatever. And I just find that that's, I think it's made me healthier and happier and I appreciate it even if I make fun of you and call you a hippie. So we still have a minute left. I don't know what else to say. We have 45 seconds left.
Ding, ding, ding. And this is how Becky has won the 3-minute spousal challenge.
Wait a minute. I didn't realize this is something you could win or lose. I think we both lose if we can't hold a conversation about a topic. No, but I definitely lost because I was thinking about something else halfway through your thing. So I wasn't thinking about what I was going to say.
But anyways, actually, I think that Deborah Madison made a really interesting point at her lecture about regional and seasonal food. Because at a farmer's market, you're not going there and getting the seasons of the world like you would at a supermarket. At a farmer's market, you get corn usually in July when corn is fresh. And when you go to the farmer's market in October, there's not really any corn there anymore because there's no farmers that have corn really in their fields that's still in good condition. And one of the interesting things that she also said was that going to different farmer's markets around the country is a really good way to experience regional specialties. In Colorado, for example, we have the Palisade peaches that come in, and they are amazingly good. But, you know, we don't have maple syrup. So if you go to a farmer's market in Vermont or, you know, in the Northeast, you're probably going to have a time of year where there's maple syrup at your farmer's market. You know, at our farmer's markets here, you know, it's hard for me to actually say, like, what grows really well in Denver, you know, aside from the peaches, which have been really excellent. Although I have to say Knoxville had really, really great peaches too. You know, we don't get like pecans, for example, like in Knoxville, the, you know, in Georgia, they grow a lot of pecans and they're excellent. I mean, the best pecans you'll ever eat, but you have to wait for them to be in season. And one of the things that she was saying is that there was a time, and if you go to Florida, this is still true, or Trader Joe's, when all fruit was sort of wrapped in cellophane or encapsulated in plastic. And she just thinks this is silly because fruits have a bouquet. They have an odor to seduce you to eat them. And if you can't go to a supermarket or a farmer's market and smell your food, that's like cheating. It's taking all of the olfactory passion and bliss out of eating. And one of the things she said was that this is a lot like cooking in a microwave, where you don't get to smell the food as you cook it and as it matures into the dish that you're going to eat. And as she was talking about this, it made me realize that this is a woman who really loves food and loves the process of food and loves the experience of eating. And I think sometimes it's important to slow down and actually enjoy your food and use the best, freshest ingredients you can every once in a while, if you can afford it, to be able to experience that food. And as I thought, like, God, she must eat like this all the time. It's like, it makes me jealous of people who make love in this way too, where like every time they do it, they can just take their time and really experience the moment. And so this is my message of the podcast, is if you go out this week, take some time to just experience the moments that you're having in your life, to fully embrace something. You know, whether it's, you know, making love or cooking a really good fresh meal with fruit that smells delicious, that makes your mouth water, it smells so good. You know, just experience something fully and completely and take your time to do it right. Like, stop rushing and just do it right. That is what that talk gave to me.
It made you think about taking your time while having sex.
Yeah, pretty much. I was sitting there and I was thinking about, you know, the peaches and the fruit and the, like, juices running all over, like, my mouth as I eat, like, this nice juicy peach, and I was like, God, I'm horny.
Did we mention that we didn't spend very much time together last week? Well, on that note, I guess we should do our last little mini segment, which is just thinking about stuff we're looking forward to for next week.
Oh, goodness.
I'll go first because I've already got one. This is actually what I was thinking about when I should have been paying attention to your initial spiel about the food. have I mentioned that I get easily distracted sometimes? I was just thinking, I'm actually really looking forward to next Saturday because we've got a couple things on tap. In the morning, we're going to get pictures, like family pictures taken for Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Mom and Dad.
Yeah. And I think that'll be a lot of fun. I mean, it may be stressful, but, you know, the pictures will be cute because we've got cute girls. And then we were going to go to the USC alumni club.
We have a birthday party in there, too.
Oh, that's right. We've got three things. So this is going to be a little bit of a crazy day. But after the birthday party, the USC is playing Cal, I think, at 1:30 local time or something like that. And there's a USC alumni club that has game watches for all the games. And this is the only afternoon game, I think, left in the season. And so we were thinking of going, and both girls have little USC song girl outfits that they can fit into now. So we're going to dress them up as little USC song girls, which would be super duper cute, and go to the USC club and watch the game and have the girl. And I actually, just yesterday, I did this with them.
Ramble.
At the Notre Dame alumni club, just me and the two girls, Loyette in her Notre Dame sweatshirt, which was on the blog yesterday. And she had a lot of fun with that. She's sitting in her high chair going, "Go Irish, go Irish." So she'll, you know, I'll just tell her to say "Go Trojans" and she will. She's very adaptable to my various bandwagons. But I think that'll be a lot of fun and I'm looking forward to it.
Wow. Gosh. I had something I was looking forward to and I forgot it. Oh, I know what it is. So for those of you who don't know, I'm taking prerequisites because I want to go back to school. And so I've been working on prereqs for a nursing program. So I'm taking anatomy and physiology too, which is wonderfully fun to like be, you know, reading these stuff while the girls are napping and doing labs and dissecting fetal pigs and things on the table when they're asleep. The life my girls don't know about. But anyways, we are moving from the lymphatic system to the respiratory system, and I am really jazzed about reading up about the respiratory system. I just think that gas exchange is really fun. So I'm kind of excited to work on, you know, the chemistry of it and also just the physiology and anatomy of it.
Gas exchange is really fun. Yeah. That could be our motto.
Yeah. That should be like the tag under this week's episode. There you go.
All right. Well, we kept it under 45 minutes this week. Yay for us. We'll end with a clip from Dave Ramsey's show, and we'll see you next week. Same time. Well, Monday at some point. Sunday night, Monday morning. Same time, same place. BrendanLloyd.com.
Have a great week.
Bye, everybody.
All right. $87,000 paid off in 23 months. 2 years. That's like $40,000 a year plus paid off, making 100 or 80 to 105 during that time. Ryan and Rachel in Nashville. Count it down, Ryan. Let's hear a great debt-free scream.
1, 2, 3. We're debt-free!
Yes! This is how it's done. Well done, you guys. Well done. I love it.